This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
His parishioners, all of them down in that awful murk. Once more, he began to run in fear toward the city.
713-526-5738. You've been listening to a performance of John Hershey's Hiroshima, the play dramatizing the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 713-526-5738 is the number to call right now to make your pledge of support. 713-526-5738. I'm Ernesto Aguilar, KPFT's program director. This hour we will be featuring the 1979 March in Washington documentary from the Pacifica Radio Archives, available tonight for your pledge of support. The From the Vault 100 set is a 100-hour set of programming featuring the segment you've been listening to, Hiroshima, the segment you'll be hearing this hour, the 1979 March in Washington, as well as programming on Stonewall, which we'll be featuring a little bit later on this evening, Quentin Crisp, and much more. Please go to your phone, dial 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. That pledge of support is tax deductible. You can put it on a Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover. You can do an electronic funds transfer. However you'd like to make that pledge, please go to your phone, dial 713-526-5738. We jump now to the 1979 March in Washington. Please give your pledge of support tonight, 713-526-5738.
Across the country lately, millions of people are marching for their rights. But this chanting you're hearing now is from a different generation. This is From the Vault Remixed, a weekly program presented by the Pacifica Radio Archives. I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the archive. Each week, we pick a subject, sometimes date-specific, sometimes seemingly random, and we go through the Pacifica Radio Archives vault, the largest of its kind in the country, and pull out the best programs possible and remix them into something we hope you'll come to look forward to, set your watches by, or grab the whole family and listen. Listen to the power of radio. This week, we look at the 1979 March on Washington for gay and lesbian rights.
Sunday, October 14th, 1979. For millions of Americans and the national media, it was just another news day. But for hundreds of thousands of lesbians, gay men, and their friends, October 14, 1979 was the date of the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights, the first such event in American history. On that day, thousands of people from all over the country converged on the nation's capital to march past the White House and to gather together at the Washington Monument for a rally of mutual support and celebration. In the spirit of significant past marches in the nation's capital, lesbians and gay men came to Washington in astonishing numbers to demonstrate to lawmakers and to the national press that the growing lesbian and gay movement for human rights and human dignity in the 1970s would continue to be a major social and political force in the 1980s.
What we really want to do with this march is build a national consciousness around gay oppression. Freedom is never given to anybody, and unless we continue in our effort without putting our energy and our direction into a further action, a further effort, we will not get our freedom because nobody's going to give it to us.
We shall go.
The march didn't just happen, though. Like all great things, it first germinated as an idea in someone's head. But today there is some controversy over who first had the idea. Ray Hill, who is the lead organizer of the event, says Harvey Milk first came up with the idea in 1976. Harvey Milk later became the first elected gay official in the country, elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors in 1977.
The conference that did call for the march happened in Philadelphia, and it happened in Independence Hall on Quaker turf, and that happened in February of 1979. Among those people that were present but not supporting the march was Troy Perry. And I've known Troy Perry since 68. So Troy and I are old friends, and Troy was just opposed to the march. The name Robin Tyler, in relationship to the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights in 1979, did not appear until Troy had a heart-to-heart talk with God and changed his position on the march and said he would support the march and lead a train from Los Angeles across the country, gathering march participants along the way. And part of that was contingent that we put Robin Tyler in a position of being on the podium with me as co-moderator of the rally at the end of the march. And that's the first time Robin Tyler's name appeared in relationship to that march. And that's just the facts.
But Robin Tyler, a lesbian comedienne, claims the idea first came to her while on stage in Minnesota.
I was doing a benefit in St. Paul when they had the referendum there, and I made a joke. The joke was going to be, I think we should march on Washington. We'll set up tents. We know how gay men love camping. Well, it got such a huge applause, I think we should march on Washington, that I said, well, I'm not going to do the rest of the joke. It's got this applause. So they formed the Minnesota Committee for the March on Washington, and then Harvey picked it up in San Francisco.
I called for that march for the day of freedom in Washington, D.C., on the same spot for over a decade ago. Dr. Martin Luther King said, I have a dream that is staying.
Today, the question of who first had the idea may be irrelevant. The important thing is that people, including both Harvey Milk and Robin Tyler, acted on the idea. But not all gays and lesbians thought it was wise at first. Around the country, groups met to discuss whether or not a march was a good idea. There was debate around the effectiveness of a march if the turnout was not enormous. The gay and lesbian community did not want to put together something of this scale and have a small turnout, which they argued would hurt their cause more than help. One of those who argued against it was Ray Hill. But Harvey Milk convinced him it was the only way to truly show the country that they were a minority population of the country that should be treated with the same rights as other minorities. But then, in the middle of this debate, tragedy struck.
At 11 a.m. this morning, San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and City Supervisor Harvey Milk were shot and killed in their City Hall offices. Board of Supervisors Dianne Feinstein, who now becomes acting mayor of San Francisco, made the announcement to a stunned group in City Hall.
As president of the Board of Supervisors, it's my duty to make this announcement. Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
Oh, Jesus Christ!
The suspect is Supervisor Dan White.
Thousands of quiet mourners have brought flowers for Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk to the steps of City Hall. For Pacifica in Berkeley, this is Lily Franklin.
In reports on that day, the emphasis was placed on Mayor Moscone's death, but it quickly became apparent that the death of Harvey Milk would be more significant historically. Milk was a hero in the gay and lesbian community because of his being elected to office, but also because he was so confident in coming out, and he encouraged all gays and lesbians to come out, saying their fight for civil rights would only be possible if their life was made public. And with his death, he instantly became a martyr. His death motivated people around the country to participate in the fight for gay rights, and undoubtedly helped inch many people closer to coming out. He famously said in one of his attempts to encourage people to come out, "Rights are not won on paper. They are won only by those who make their voices heard." debate that had taken place about how effective a march would be if there was a small turnout had instigated gay rights groups across the country to organize train and bus trips to the Capitol. These trips were in some instances a multi-day traveling celebration.
The question of the day is, are you going to Washington, D.C.?
If I have to walk on my hands to Washington, I'm going to be there.
All over.
Aboard the Amtrak Freedom Train as it left the Oakland, California terminal, carrying some 75 lesbians and gay men to Sunday's National March on Washington for lesbian and gay rights.
The journey on the train has superseded my expectations many times over. I really am enjoying the sense of community, as short-lived a community as it will be, just, you know, less than a week.
I can't say the word. I don't know the word to say. It's been wonderful.
What's your name?
Dennis.
How long have you been working the railroad, Dennis?
Oh, about 30 years.
Is this going to be a trip you're going to remember?
Oh, I remember this trip for real. I never will forget this trip.
What is really exciting is that there are committees working in 49 of the 50 states.
Los Angeles March Committee organizer Susan McGreevy spent the last few weeks before the march working out of the Washington, D.C. office.
The only state that is not covered at this point is Nevada. The march has caught the imagination, I think, of a lot of people in the country.
I like the political interaction between the men and women. I'm real impressed with that. I'm seeing more and more of it, and I'm real involved in politics, and it's nice to be able to talk to men about politics.
The only thing I can say, I haven't slept much on this whole trip. I think we're probably all excited enough to where it is not bothering us that we haven't slept for 2 days now.
Dallas, Texas has 20 billboards going up there and in Austin, and they're taking some of those billboards away from fundamentalist religious groups, and they have even organized vigilante committees to make sure that they are not defaced in any way.
I appreciate the fact that we're not alone on this train, as we are not alone in the rest of the world. We have to talk to these people, and that's why we're going to Washington.
Jesse, is there anything you can compare this crowd to in your experience on the train?
Lovely, lovely crowd. I had some nice crowds, but this is the most loveliest crowd I've had.
How long have you been working on the railroad?
31 years. Still, people got nothing but compliments from all other people. Looks like they made that trip more happy. The eyes are open more now, I guess.
There's an old line communist on the train, and there's a Bircher who thinks the metric system is a communist conspiracy. We've had a chance to talk to all of those people. And that's what it was all about.
It's like one big family. And I didn't expect that. Because I'm not out that much, I didn't know what to expect, really. But it's like everybody knows each other. And it's a great feeling. I love it.
We are calling. Heaven knows where we are going.
This collage came from a documentary produced at Pacifica Radio immediately after the march. Remember, though, this is 1979, and not all of the country took the gay movement as welcome news. In Utah, some writers had the dubious honor of meeting Reverend Robert L. Harris, the first black elected official in that state.
The power of God is against you, Bill. We don't appreciate the being here.
October 11th. Early Thursday morning, Ogden, Utah.
This is worse. This is the worst sin in the Bible.
Where did this come from?
God's going to have somebody that's going to tell you devil the truth.
Say that. What is this?
You read the verse in scripture.
I have read the Bible. I've read Romans 1:26 through 28, 1 Corinthians 6:9, 1 Timothy 1:9 through 10. Listen, it was the story because God couldn't find 10 righteous people in it, period. That's what the scriptures say. Nothing to do with homosexuality.
Homosexuality is the worst sin in the Bible. It's worse than the Bible. Like I say, I love you devils, but I'm going to tell you the truth, see. God is not pleased with you, see. And you know, most people don't have enough guts. Most preachers don't have enough guts. I surely admire Anita Bryant. Most people don't have enough guts. I really admire her. Most people don't have enough guts to tell you crooks the truth. See? But this is the only religious state headed by officials of the country. We definitely don't appreciate you coming here.
We're on on our way to Washington, D.C. to demand our rights, and we're going to Washington.
You have no rights.
Yes, we do.
You have no rights.
There was a time when you were told as a black you didn't have rights.
You have no rights. You have no rights. You're
a black George Washington.
You have no rights.
We do.
The only rights you have is a turn to the Lord. The power of God's gift. My name is Reverend Robert L. Harris.
Mighty right.
And I go a little farther than that. I'm the first black elected official in Utah, the only one.
We heard you plan to throw yourself on the tracks. Is that something that you still plan to do, that they're going to allow you to do?
I've already done it. I laid on the tracks, yes.
Did they ask you to leave or anything?
No, they didn't know. This is a religious thing. They appreciate me doing something like this.
You did it as a gesture. I mean, you're not going to threaten your life by the train, are you?
No, I'm not going to threaten my life. I just doing this to let them know we don't appreciate them being here. God is against you.
You have homosexual.
The power of God is against you.
It goes without saying, the party on the train did not end because of the men and women along the way who protested the train's passengers. More than likely, it fueled that energy on board. The party lasted for a couple days as the train meandered across the country. Then on Saturday, the train pulled into Washington, D.C.
The Freedom Train has just arrived this moment, and the passengers are about to disembark, and here they are.
We just finished coming across the country on what we called Amtrak.
Saturday night, October 13th, the Sylvan Theater, Washington, D.C.
At the Sylvan Theater in D.C., on the eve of the march organizers put together a show as part of the events going on that weekend.
People that are going to be on this show are going to be out of the closet, lesbian and gay entertainers only.
You have been listening to a vital voice to our community. It's important and it's worth supporting. It also reflects the uniqueness of this radio station. I'm G.D. Doyle of Queer Voices. Sometimes listeners want to know, just who do we think we are? KPFT is education. KPFT enriches the lives of listeners by encouraging people to learn throughout their lives. KPFT is a pioneer of gay, lesbian, bi, and trans media for the community and those who may not be a part of the community but believe sounds like this should have a space on the airwaves. You can find extraordinary information on your radio. Dialogue, music, the world, cutting-edge ideas, and amazing discoveries. KPFT is the arts. Performing arts and the news about the arts have a home here. And as you're hearing this hour, KPFT is history. Programming like this makes our community's fascinating past come alive. Programming like what you've been listening to celebrates our differences and our similarities. We are democracy. News, information, debates, documentaries, legislative action, these are the tools that responsible people need to make decisions for the future of their community, families, state, and nation. KPFT is all of us. We look at people, places, and faces throughout the community. We bring you dozens of programs each year produced by, about, and for all of us. KPFT is you. But restoring historic voices is not cheap. And broadcasting this on not just a special month, day, or anniversary, but every day isn't free either. Make a generous contribution today to radio that really matters. By giving KPFT a financial contribution, you do something great for the community, and you get a great thank you gift too. Here's the number to call.
That number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Please make that pledge right now. You are listening to Remembering, or the 1979 March on Washington, featuring some impressive voices on the first March for Gay and Lesbian Rights in Washington, D.C. We will be dropping back to that recording, but right now we need to remind you that you can get this recording along with many important recordings, including Remembering Stonewall, which we'll be featuring in the next hour, The Feminist Journey, Quentin Crisp, and much more. That 100 hours of programming from the Pacifica Radio Archives is available tonight for your $200 pledge. Your number to call right now, please go to your phone. Please make that call. 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT to make your pledge of support. That pledge makes such a difference this hour. Please make that pledge. We need to hear from you. 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT to make your pledge of support. That From the Vault 100 set available for your $200 pledge. 100 great hours of programming available now. Give us a ring. 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT to make your pledge of support. 713-526-5738. Please make that pledge right now. 713-526-KPFT. We'll go back to the 1979 March in Washington, picking up that recording from where we left off. You can get a copy of this recording for your tax-deductible contribution. 713-526-5738.
Come out of the closet and love me. Come out of the closet. Be free. Come out of the closet. Come. I know it's the dark in there. So come out with a scream and shout and see everybody everywhere.
We can get our sisters and brothers on the streets of Washington saying that we are everywhere. We are together. We're gay. We're proud. We're strong, and this year is the year.
We cannot have people come to this country on visas. We are kicked by police. We have no employment rights. You can be put in jail for holding hands with your lovers in practically half the states of the United States.
It's time we recognize that this is a national issue. It has got national support.
We know politicians talk out of both sides of their mouths. And we want to know what they're going to do this year, not next year, with promises.
We are going to ensure them of their civil rights and of their human rights, because we are going to save our children.
In 1969, outside the Stonewall Bar in New York City, for the first time in America, gay men and women demonstrated in the streets for their human rights. In the 10 years since the Stonewall riots, lesbians and gay men have fought to end the ignorance and discrimination surrounding homosexuality. But many Americans still oppose this effort, some with a Bible, others with violence. And this is what brings hundreds of thousands of gay men and women to the mall today in Washington, D.C. They've come from all across the nation, and many from abroad, to march from the Capitol building, march up Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House, and finally turning south to gather here by the Washington Monument. And many more gay men and women who cannot be with us in Washington today will be able to hear the voices of gay liberation in this national broadcast. And now, from the Washington Monument in our nation's capital, we bring you the rally at the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights.
And welcome to the rally. I'm Moira Rankin from the Soap.
Wonderful time.
So nice to see a whole bunch of dykes.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. I feel so supported. So much a part of this.
You know, somebody said last night at the concert that there's like really two cultures here, gay men and gay women, and they're very, very different. There needs to be respect for the differences. Do you feel that way?
I feel that way, and I feel like there is respect here. There's been no antagonism that I can possibly see at all.
I think everybody's so happy that so many people turned out that everybody thinks it's a miracle, and they're just celebrating together. Okay, Del, do you want to add for the national audience? You want to say hi, Mom?
Hello, Mother. Hi, Mom.
Thank you very much. This is Amy Sands and David Wynyard.
Bread and water, like some poor man's daughter, no, never for me. Wine and money, call me honey, and maybe feel I was free. Like a glass raised too many times, I broke in two. Sing it. I was walking around in
been a long road.
The march was peaceful and described by all participants as a tremendous success. There were some arrests, but not for violence. Reporter David Myers interviewed one man whose celebration ended abruptly.
We're talking here to Brett Booth, who participated in the March on Washington today, and he was in his uniform and was arrested. Can you tell us about that, Brett?
Yeah, I was marching down through the watch, through the march, and from behind a military police patrol had grabbed a hold of me and pulled me out of the march and took me down to the station.
And you were incarcerated at that point, I guess.
Exactly.
Did they actually put you in jail then?
Yes, they did. They slapped the handcuffs on when I got to the vehicle, and they kept the handcuffs on. I had to submit to a full search, and they put me behind a cage, not behind bars, but behind a cage, and I sat there by myself for about an hour while they were processing all the papers and legalities and whatnot.
David Myers then asked the sailor about life in the Navy, and it bore little similarity to the Village People song.
Do you find much hostility in the services towards gay people then?
Very much so. At my command, well, 2 months ago I was stationed on a ship, and because the ship found out that I was gay, I had 17 verbal threats and about 27 physical threats, attempts on my life to put me over the side while the ship was underway. And the ship had left for the Mediterranean, and so the captain realized what was going on, and so he stationed me on the base rather than staying on the ship because he knew that I was going to go over if I took the trip over there.
So your life was actually threatened then?
Definitely. Too many times. It's very scary, very, very shaky. But I've coped with it for this long, and I feel now that I have even more things to fight for at a stronger point of view, and I've got people to back me up and people to help me. And like I said before, I'll fight to the top.
Reporter David Myers was able to briefly interview Kevin Muller, who is one of the event organizers and who had gone to the jail to look after the arrested sailor.
I was flabbergasted. I've been involved in this 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for at least 5 months. I always believed in it. And I'm the outpouring, the people, the emotions just overwhelm me. At one point, I was introducing the various groups as they came down the street, and I had to stop because I just had tears in my eyes. It was just I couldn't even talk. I think it's important to bring out that this was not just a local endeavor. We had representatives from all of our states, from 21 countries. I met 4 women who came in from New Zealand just for the demonstration. I met some women from Adak, Alaska. Now, Adak, Alaska is in the Aleutian Islands, and it is 90 miles from Soviet Russia. So that's not exactly around the corner. The people were very well behaved. We had no problems. The only incident was the reason we're here, was Brett's arrest. But I'm just so thrilled, and from what I've heard, there are plans for another march on Washington. I'll be very happy one day when we don't have to have a march anywhere. But we are everywhere, and I think the most important thing about today's demonstration, and this must be brought out, is that we are everywhere. Traditionally in this country, when gay things happen, gay news happens, it's just in New York or California, the larger metropolis areas. But we had representatives from little towns we never knew existed. We are everywhere, and we're a politically active group.
The arrests were not the only controversy of the day. After the march, there was a contentious debate regarding the official count of the march. Estimates ranged from the ridiculous at 25,000 to the impressive at 250,000. Unfortunately, the 250,000 count was announced after someone overheard a police officer say, while pointing to the Washington Mall, "There must be 250,000 fags out there." In the end, the final number was estimated at 80,000. And finally, let's hear a cross-section of voices from that historic day, nearly 30 years ago.
In San Francisco, when they sentenced Dan White to 7 years, our brothers and our sisters got on the streets
to express their grief and their outrage, and they burned a couple of police cars, and they dared to call us violence. Well, they don't have to tell us about violence, because they have violated us since the beginning of time.
I come from an organization where in the last 5 years, 12 of our churches have been arson and burned down to the ground. In one case, our minister and 10 of our church members were burned to death because of oppression, because of arson. When I hear people like Anita Bryant and Jerry Farwell from Lynchburg, Virginia, I think that town is aptly named, it really bothers me. People who claim the name of God, shame on you, you hypocrites. Let me tell you now, you don't know God. You couldn't possibly know God. I'm telling you today, as gay men and gay women, as we gather here on the Mall, we can have our victory. We can have our power. We have it already. We don't owe apologies to anyone in America. Not anymore. We're here to let Americans know we're your sons, your daughters. We're not going away. We're here, and we're going to have our civil rights no matter what. It's for us.
We really threaten uptight America, because one of the most effective ways to control people is through sex, through shame, through guilt. Remember it. We are the agents of one of the most important social transformations that has ever taken place since the beginning of patriarchy. But don't forget, we're outlaws. It's our great advantage. That's why I recommend it to you. We are the only minority group also that you can join overnight. In the twinkling of an eye, in fact. We dared to know pleasure. May I say pleasure again? I don't think it's been mentioned much today. Fellow criminals, never forget your nights in the days of your fighting for their freedom. Remember this experience. It is the tenderest, finest moment of our lives. So keep loving, keep making love, and soon there will be enough. Thank you.
The real irony of the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights was that it both fulfilled and fell short of everyone's expectations. Those who warned that the age of apathy could not be overcome were surprised by the thousands of people who came from all over the country. Those who imagined that the march's success would advance the lesbian and gay liberation movement to a position of real power were surprised to discover that the impact of any event is determined by the significance granted it by the mass media. Thus is history reported and recorded. If a tree falls in the forest with no one to hear, does it make a sound?
You've been listening to From the Vault Remixed, a weekly program produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives. For more information on this program, or to find information on how to purchase a copy of this program or any of the archived materials that were used within this week's program, go online at fromthevaultradio.org or call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's fromthevaultradio.org or 800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle. Senior producer is Mark Torres, production coordinator Edgar Toledo, outreach by Sean Dellis. Our theme music is courtesy of Los Angeles-based Parallel. For more information on Parallel or other music used within this week's program, please visit fromthevaultradio.org. This program was executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and myself. I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening.
a picture of time. Well, it was the mother of America. He was my self-determined guru. Myself, well, I hold your big fat heart in my hand. Well, I hold your bleeding heart in my hand. A supernova, a flame. Pain. Who holds the mirror up to fools? And I'll murder the ingrate.
You have been listening to Remember the 1979 March on Washington for Gay and Lesbian Rights, our feature this evening, and available for your pledge of support. We have much more of that program that we want to feature, including some segments from a young Ray Hill, one of the forefathers of the station, and certainly an icon in the gay and lesbian community here in the city of Houston. I'm Ernesto Aguilar, KPFT's program director, asking you to please go to your phone to make a pledge of support right now for KPFT. The From the Vault set that we're offering this evening features the 1979 March on Washington, hour-long documentary you've been listening to and will be listening to in moments, as well as segments on Quentin Crisp, Remembering Stonewall, which we will be airing in just a little less than an hour. You'll want to stay tuned for that in the 9 o'clock hour, but right now we need to ask for your contribution. 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT to make your contribution. Again, 713-526-5738. We jump back to the 1979 March on Washington. We want to give this documentary to you. Your pledge of support right now will make a big difference for KPFT and will get us closer to our goal, and you'll get a thank you gift that includes the hour you're listening to for your pledge. 713-526-5738. Please make that pledge of support. Show you care about KPFT by making that contribution. 713-526-5738.
Steve, a blind man from Arizona, was separated from his state contingent. He is behind the stage. Will someone from his state contingent come and be with Steve? Let us not leave this man alone. All right? How many people feel good today? I wish they'd take the roof off of this thing, because you've got the sunshine and we all need it.
That is our guest this week, Ray Hill, making an announcement at the historic Gay and Lesbian March on Washington in 1979. This week, we invited Ray, a man who is a bona fide legend in the gay rights movement, whose accomplishments include founding the Houston Human Rights League, the Houston Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, the Wildenstein Radio Show, which was one of the first regularly scheduled gay and lesbian programs in the country, and the only one in the South in the 1970s. He was the author of the first Safe Sex pamphlet in the country to prevent the spread of HIV, and he was the chair of the executive and coordinating committees for the March on Washington for Gay and Lesbian Rights back in 1979, among many, many other things. And a little FYI on his website bio, it also mentions he is currently unattached and reasonably available. Not exactly sure what that means, but if you're curious or bi-curious, you can read more about Ray at rayhill.info.
Ray chose to hear the audio from a meeting he was at with Harvey Milk, the slain gay politician from San Francisco, who was voted one of the 100 most important people of the 20th century by Time magazine. Howard Wallace, a longtime peace activist, union organizer, and gay rights activist. And David Lamble, a gay rights activist and journalist who recorded the meeting. A couple of days ago, From the Vault producer Christopher Sprinkle talked to Ray about how the meeting came about.
I was there 30 years ago, and one does not easily forget conversations one had in 1978 with Harvey Milk, because that was the last year he was here, and he was such a significant figure in gay and lesbian history that for me, I have gone back over those memories a thousand times, because it was certainly significant in my career as an activist. Harvey had been invited to Dallas to be the keynote speaker at a Texas Gay Task Force conference, and I was invited up from Houston to do a series of workshops on how to deal with the media. And so we were both kind of conference honchos, and that meant, this is Dallas, remember, that we each had separate limousines and drivers to carry us around. And so Harvey grabbed me in the hall and said, look, I want you to support this March on Washington that I am planning for the 10th anniversary of Stonewall. And I said, well, I have some reservations about that. And he said, well, let's sit down and see if we can iron out your concerns. And so Dave Lamble was around, and I had known Dave from his radio days in commercial radio in Houston. And Dave said, well, why don't we go over to my place? We couldn't ride in the same limousine because these are Dallas Queens putting on Dallas Queen Airs. So we each had to take our separate limousines to Dave's, which fortunately wasn't too far away, and went over there and went into Dave's house. And it was Dave Lamble, Howard Wallace of the AFL-CIO San Francisco, the gay union guy, and myself, with Harvey Milk. And first, Harvey and I squared off on the issue of the march. That didn't take more than 15 minutes because I had an idea that going a march on Washington was going to be extremely expensive in terms of transportation cost and out-of-town hotel rooms. And I said, this thing's going to cost millions of dollars if it's any way at all successful. And we could much cheaper accomplish nearly the same thing if we had a National Lesbian and Gay Rights Congress, elect delegates from every city. And he said, well, how can you do that? These people are at war with each other in every one of these cities. And I said, well, you have some kind of independent agents, call a conference. And I was doing just that in Houston. We had Houston Town Meeting 1 as an example that it could be done, where even there were warring tribes get together under a common roof and elect delegates and then send those to the Congress. But Harvey convinced me that there wasn't enough focus nationally to do that, and it would be far to our advantage to have a march on Washington.
And now we hear this meeting recorded in 1978 in David Lamble's kitchen in Dallas, Texas.
To other people at large, because we are a form of target practice for the ultra-right. They are going to build their ranks. We can guarantee one thing, that the ultra-right is going to be stronger in terms of hardcore fanatics by November. We will probably also be much stronger in terms of hardcore.
I don't call it the ultra-right. I call it the third right.
Third right.
Okay. Well, it's a bad pun, but
it does have this difference from the McCarthy period and from the right-wing reaction in the 60s. They never had a real hold on youth. They never had a real mass movement in either of those periods. I lived through the McCarthy period. I guess Harvey did, too.
There was never that kind of activism.
There was never that kind of activism. I was political then in high school. And now with the religious fundamentalism, they're able to attract sectors of the population into a mass movement for the first time. And that's really just what distinguishes fascism. It's not a right-wing. Every right-wing dictatorship is not fascist.
Well,
California is a very conservative political theater to fight in. Ronald Reagan has done his coalitions out there for a long time, and the Republican Party, in its most conservative manifestation, is given its birth in California. Now, let's, rhetoric aside, let us look at this analytically and see what kind of serious political problem are we facing there. Is there any hope?
Yes. Let's relate to Texas, because it's easy to understand. The estimates I hear of high as the potentially of 1 million people in Texas are gay. Mm-hmm. Let's say there's only 500,000. What's the total population of Texas?
13 million.
If every gay person, and they're not going to do this, but if every gay person in Texas were to come out, not stand on the street corner and scream, "I'm gay," come out just to their mother and fathers, brothers and sisters, aunts, uncles, nephews, cousins, come out to their next door neighbor, come out to the people they work with next door, to the waiter, waitresses at the restaurants they go to, the bus driver they may be, just the people they know every day on a day-to-day basis, and say, "Hey, you know, we're not talking about gay rights. We're talking about my rights, my individual rights, me. You know, I am your child, I'm your neighbor, I'm your friend, I'm your worker." If every gay person were to do that, that 500,000 would be each probably talking to 5, 6, 10 people. They'd in essence be talking to everybody in the state. Then soon, all 13 million people in the state will know personally a gay person. And every poll, every study shows that the people who are on our side are people who know a gay person personally. And that's what some of us are hoping is done in California, is, at least I'm doing it, sure, is calling on every gay person to stand up and tell just the closest people they know, not to make a federal case out of it, just to say, "Hey, Mom and Dad, it's me." I know the answer is, well, hey, you know, you don't want to hurt your mother and father. But when your mother and father go in the voting booth, you want them to hurt you.
For sure.
And so that, I think, can be won that way. There are other aspects of the campaigns. There'll be the campaigns that will do the intellectual approach through media and literature, trying to reach those who will be convinced intellectually. There'll be the campaigns that are reached, do emotional campaigns for those people who are reached emotionally. There are the campaigns probably that'll have to fear people into it, you know. Many people feel that one of the reasons the blacks were successful in getting as much as they have in relation to their population in a short time was they burned down Watts. And people saying, "Hey, they're going to burn down their own towns and cities. When are they going to burn down ours? So let's give it to them." And then there's going to be the massive outreach effort, the grassroots efforts of reaching out to different groups and getting leaders and everything else to explain to their people, getting union leaders to talk to rank and files, getting blacks to talk to blacks and so forth. It's got to be a multi-level campaign. And if it's done, then I think you'll get win.
I think it'll be the most grassroots campaign that's been carried on any place in the country. And I understand from some people in St. Paul that there was pretty good mobilization there. If that's the case, then it is not surprising they did a little bit better than in some cities. But it will be very different from the Miami campaign, where it was mostly mass media, very abstract human rights, which it's a slogan, an abstract slogan. And people rarely met gay people on the streets. There were 3,000 to 5,000 fundamentalists on the streets for 2 solid months.
See, in Eugene, Oregon...
And no gay people.
In Eugene, Oregon, the last weeks, all of a sudden, everybody had their doorbell rang, and they opened the door, and there was a mother with a little child, and said, "Protect my child," you know. They didn't say that 95% of child molestation is heterosexual, and usually by the parent. And they didn't tell that child abuse is always by the parent. But they did that kind of campaign, and that has to be overcome.
It was graphic, and it was personal.
You know, we have to do the same thing. We have to make it a very personal campaign, and we have to talk about the myths. We cannot not talk, we cannot just say we can't talk about child molestation. We must talk about child molestation. And the child molestation, 95% of it is heterosexual, mostly by the parents. We must talk about model images and role images, that a child's sexual orientation is developed by the age of 2 to 6. We must talk about pornography. That Marquis de Sade was heterosexual, and whatever, within the gay community, we still haven't seen things like Mother of Six performed live sex act. We haven't seen those things yet. So every time they're going to smear us, and I think we must start talking about it now. And the best way to talk about it is the one-to-one. And so I think it can be one, or a few of us think it can be one, and we certainly got to do our best.
Well, looking at the Houston, Texas scene as objectively as possible, and I can't be as objective as I'd like to be in looking at that sort of thing, I'd be willing to assist in the launch of such a defensive campaign against something like Briggs 5-6 years from now, provided we didn't lose everywhere else, and that drove people into a fear-panic situation. I mean, you haven't said anything here that hasn't been said for 15 years, Harvey.
But they haven't done it. You see, they haven't done it. I'm talking about one thing, coming out. After Dade County, a million people came out, you know, I use that figure, who knows how many, and never go back. And we found, most of those found that all those fears of coming out just didn't come true. Oh, yeah, some people lost their jobs. But the greatest number of people found nothing happened. And, like, right now I'm working with some 90 gay doctors and psychiatrists in the Bay Area. People don't realize how many doctors are gay. If they come out, that'll make a change in stereotypes. We've talked about it, but it's never happened. One of the myths that we have in this country is that, you know, all gay people come from San Francisco, Hollywood, and New York, right? Like we're cloned, you know, off the supermarket shelf. So I'm suggesting that, that on Gay Day, and maybe you should do it, think about it, doing it at Town Hall.
Town meeting,
I'm sorry. I'm suggesting in San Francisco that on Gay Day, everybody show up with the sign of the town they're born in, you know, to show that we come from all over, that we are their children. The reason everybody thinks that all gay people come from, straight people think they all, we all come from Hollywood, is that if indeed we came from Hillsboro, Oklahoma, or Madison, Wisconsin, or Rochester, New York, if we came from those places, then there's a possibility, well, then we naturally belong to somebody in those towns and cities, and there's a possibility that the parents own this. You know, we are their children. So in order to avoid that my child is gay, all gay people have to come from San Francisco and Hollywood. And we have to dispel that myth. And if everybody showed up, just all 6,000, you pack that Astor Arena, wherever it's going to be, with everybody had the signs of their hometown where they're born in, people say, hey, they're from all over. We have to dispel the myths. We've never done that. In Miami and in all those other places, we never talked about the myths.
You've been listening to the voice of Harvey Milk, featured on Remembering Stonewall, the segment that is available this evening for your pledge of support. Please make that call, 713-526-5738. The 1979 March on Washington, Remembering Stonewall, and so much more, all features tonight on this special evening of fundraising for KPFT. Please make that pledge. We'll jump right back to programming, but we want to ask for that pledge of support. That From the Vault 100 CD set, or 100 hour set, is 100 hours of CDs available from the Pacifica Radio Archives for your contribution. Please go to the phone, make your pledge right now, 713-526-5738.
A blind man from Arizona was separated from his state contingent. He is behind the stage. Will someone from his state contingent come and be with Steve? Let us not leave this man alone. All right? How many people feel good today? I wish they'd take the roof off of this thing, because you've got the sunshine and we all need it.
713-526-5738. The From the Vault CD set is available for your tax-deductible contribution. Please make that pledge. Make it now. 713-526-5738. You are listening to KPFT Houston. I'm Ernesto Aguilar, KPFT's program director. We're asking for your contribution this evening. Please make that pledge of support. We go now this hour to Remembering Stonewall, the Pacifica Radio Archives documentary that is part of this historic set of audio, please go to your phone now and dial 713-526-KPFT.
This is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. In June 1990, David Isay produced Remembering Stonewall, Birth of a Movement. A few years later, David Isay would receive a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, otherwise known as the MacArthur Foundation Genius Grants, and the accompanying $500,000, no strings attached money, helped him create the award-winning Sound Portraits, which now airs radio documentaries on National Public Radio and Public Radio International. Like so many legendary radio producers and journalists, Isay got started inside the Pacifica Radio Network, although he did not stay for long. In 1987, Isay was chatting with the owners of a bookstore specializing in 12-step programs. Inquiring about the store, he discovered both were recovering drug addicts and were planning to open a museum of addiction. Isay immediately raced home and started calling New York television and radio stations trying to generate interest in the story. He ended up speaking with Amy Goodman, who was news director at Pacifica station WBAI in New York at the time. She said the story sounded great and admitted she didn't have anyone to do the story. In true Pacifica style, she asked Isay, "Why don't you do it?" He borrowed a tape recorder and a mic and went out and recorded sound. With editing help from Amy Goodman, he put together his first six-minute piece. As fate had it, NPR producer Gary Covino was in New York at the time and was listening to WBAI when Isay's piece aired. He loved it so much, he contacted Isay and helped him re-edit it for NPR, and just like that, Isay started his lifelong relationship with NPR. Not long after, when Isay was 22 years old, he found out his father was gay and had a lover. Shocked by the revelation, he set out to try to understand the secret life his father had been leading. With a grant from the Pacifica National Programming Fund, Isay interviewed veterans of the Stonewall Uprising, the 1969 clash between gays and the police, which violently began the gay rights movement. The documentary aired on Pacifica and then on National Public Radio, becoming Isay's first documentary to air on NPR. Remembering Stonewall is a beautiful, elegant oral history of the people who spoke up and fought for their own rights, as well the rights of millions of other gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgendered across the country. And in this half hour, we'll hear the 25-minute production.
I am Gene Harwood, and my age is 80.
I'm Bruce Merrill.
He also would like to know what your age is. So you
my
tell
age, 78. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't know if it's really true, but now people do refer to us as the two oldest gay men in America. We do, have maybe a record relationship of almost 60 years together. Bruce's memory started going bad in 1984. Fortunately, we have our music together, which we've done over the years. We've written any number of songs. Bruce remembers the melodies very well and the lyrics for the songs.
When you touched me, when you took my hand, something happened I had never planned.
Being gay before Stonewall was a very difficult proposition, because we felt that in order to survive, we had to try to look and act as straight as possible. The general attitude of society, as far as employers were concerned and landlords, all of these people were very hostile, and to protect ourselves, we had to act as rugged and manly as possible to get by in
my name
in
is
the
Randy Wicker. I was the first openly gay person to appear on radio in 1962 and on television in 1964 as a self-identified homosexual. In the year before Stonewall, people felt a need to hide. Because of the precarious legal position they were in, they would lose their jobs. there was a great hostility, socially speaking, in the sense of people found out you were gay, they assumed you were a communist or a child molester or any of another dozen stereotypes that were rampant in the public media at the time.
I'm Jerry Fair, and I'm 80 years old. I started a gay lifestyle in 1948, when I was around 39 or 40. At that time, if there was even a suspicion that you were gay, that you were a lesbian, you were fired from your job, and you were in such a position of disgrace that you slunk out without saying goodbye even to the people that liked you and you liked, never even bothered to clean your desk. You just disappeared. You just disappeared. You went quietly because you were afraid that the recriminations that would come if you even stood there and protested would be worse than just leaving.
My name is Sylvia Rivera. My name before that was Ray Rivera until I started dressing in drag in 1961. The era before Stonewall was a hard era. There was always the gay bashings on the drag queens by heterosexual men, women, and the police. We learned to live with it because it was part of the lifestyle at that time, I guess. But none of us were very happy about it.
My name is Seymour Pine. In 1968, I was assigned as deputy inspector in charge of public morals in the first division in the police department, which covered South Manhattan from 38th Street to the Battery, including the Greenwich Village area. It was the duty of public morals to enforce all laws concerning vice and gambling, including prostitution, narcotics, and laws and regulations concerning homosexuality. The part of the penal code which applied to drag queens was section 240.35, section 4. Being masked or in any manner disguised by unusual or unnatural attire or facial alteration, loiters, remains, or congregates in a public
place. At that time, we lived at the Arista Hotel. We sit around, just try to figure out when this harassment would come to an end. And we would always dream that one day it would come to an end. And we prayed and we looked for it. We wanted to be human beings.
My name is Red Mahoney. I've been hanging out, drinking, partying, and working in the gay bars for the last 30 years. In the era before Stonewall, all of the bars, 90% of the bars, were mafia-controlled. They were controlled because the mafia had the right connections. There wasn't that many gay bars. You'd have maybe one, two uptown on the Upper East Side. They would get closed down, and there'd be one or two on the West Side. They'd get closed down, and Midtown, there'd be one, two, three, maybe open. As they would get closed down, they'd move around, and they would dump.
I'm Joan Nessel, co-founder of what is now the largest collection of lesbian culture in the world. The police raided lesbian bars regularly, and they did it. They both did it in the most obvious way, which was hauling women away in paddy wagons. But there was regular weekend harassment, which would consist of the police coming in regularly to get their payoffs. And in the Sea Colony, we had a back room with a red light. And when that red light went on, it meant the police would be arriving in around 10 minutes. And so we all had to sit down at our tables. And we would be sitting there almost like school children. And the cops would come in. Now, depending on who was on, which cop was on, if it was some that really resented the butch women, who were with many times very beautiful women, we knew were in for it, because what would happen is they would start harassing one of these women and saying, "Huh, you think you're a man? Come outside, we'll show you." And the woman would be dragged away, they throw up against a wall, and they'd say, "So you think you're a man? Let's see what you got in your pants." And they would put their hand down her pants.
The Stonewall. Oh, that was a good one. That was. Just to get into the Stonewall, you'd walk up and you'd knock on the front door. You'd knock and the little door would open and, "Hey, what do you want?" "A Mary sent me." "Good. Come on in, girls." You know, when you walked in, to your right was your bar room and no windows. Down at the far end of the bar was an opening in the wall going into the dance room with the jukebox in that room. And no windows in that room either. The Stonewall, like all gay bars at that time, were painted black. Charcoal black. And what was the funny part? The place would be so dimly lit, but as soon as the cops were going to come in to collect their percentage or whatever they were coming in for, from it being a nice, dimly lit dump, the place was lit up like Luna Park.
Well, two guys, and that's very often all we sent in, would be two men. Could handle 200 people. I mean, you tell them to leave, and they leave, and you say, "Show me your identification," and they all take out their identification and file out, and that's it. And you say, "Okay, you're not a man, you're a woman," or you're vice versa, and you wait over there. I mean, this is a kind of power that you have, and you never gave it a second thought.
The drag queen took a lot of oppression, and we had to... We were at a point where I guess nothing would have stopped us. I guess, as they say, or as Shakespeare says, we were ladies in waiting, just waiting for the thing to happen. And when it did happen, we were there.
On Friday night, June 27, 1969, at about 11:45, eight officers from Public Morals 1st Division loaded into four unmarked police cars. From their headquarters on 21st Street and 3rd Avenue, they headed downtown and then west towards the Stonewall Inn here at 7th Avenue and Christopher Street. It was the second time the bar was raided that week. The local 6th Precinct had just received a new commanding officer who kicked off his tenure by initiating a series of raids on gay bars. And New York was in the midst of a mayoral campaign, always a bad time for homosexuals. Mayor John Lindsay had good reason to agree to the police crackdown. He had just lost his party's primary and needed a popularity boost. And the Stonewall Inn was indeed an inviting target. Operated by the Gambino crime family without a liquor license, this dance bar drew a crowd of drag queens, hustlers, minors, and more masculine lesbians known as bull dykes. Many were black or Hispanic. It was a warm night in New York City and a somber day for many. Judy Garland, who had died earlier in the week, was buried that morning. It was almost precisely at midnight that the Moral Squad pulled up to the Stonewall Inn, led by Deputy Inspector Seymour Pine.
There was never any reason to feel that anything of any unusual situation would occur that night.
You could actually feel it in the air. You really could. I guess Judy Garland's death just really helped us really hit the fan.
For some reason, things were different this night. As we were bringing the prisoners out, they were resisting.
People started gathering in front of the Sheridan Square Park right across the street from Stonewall. People were upset. "No, we're not going to go." And people started screaming and hollering.
One drag queen, as we put her in the car, opened the door on the other side and jumped out. At which time we had to chase that person. And he was caught, put back into the car. He made another attempt to get out the same door, the other door. And at that point, we had to handcuff the person. From this point on, things really began to get crazy.
My name is Robert Rivera, and my nickname is Birdie, and I've been cross-dressing all of my life. I remember the night of the riots. The police were escorting the queens out of the bar and into the paddy wagon. And there was this one particularly outrageously beautiful queen with stacks and stacks of Elizabeth Taylor style hair. And she was asking them not to push her. And they continued to push her, and she turned around and she mashed the cop with her high heel. She knocked him down, and then she proceeded to frisk him for the keys to the handcuffs that were on him. She got them, and she undid herself and passed them to another queen that was behind her.
Well, that's when all hell broke loose.
You are listening to Remembering Stonewall, documentary of the Stonewall Rebellion in New York. I hate to interrupt this audio. Some really impressive first-person accounts of Stonewall. I want to get back to that right now, but I also need to ask for a pledge of support. I'm Ernesto Aguilar, KPFT's program director. We're asking for your pledge of support for KPFT, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Please make that pledge of support. You can pick up this documentary, the one you've been listening to, for your $60 pledge for Remembering Stonewall. If you'd like to pick up the entire 100 hours of From the Vault programming via the Pacifica Radio Archives, that is available for your $200 pledge. Again, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT is the number to call right now. I've got Matt out of Pledge Central, looks like, but right now we're going to ask for your pledge of support, 713-526-5738. Matt, I know we've got some folks to thank out there.
Yeah, we do. We've got at least three. I'd like to thank Candace right here in Houston for
fabulous
for ponying up some money on their fantastic plastic.
Great.
And I'd like to thank Philip right here in Houston. And also James.
Thank you so much, James. 713-526-5738. That is the number to call right now to make that pledge of support. Remembering Stonewall, the documentary you've been listening to, available for your $60 pledge. You can pick up the entire From the Vault set, 100 hours of programming, for a $200 pledge. 713-526-5738. We return to Remembering Stonewall. Please make your pledge of support right now for KPFT.
You're listening to From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week, we're remembering Stonewall.
And then we had to get back into Stonewall.
My name is Howard Smith. On the night of the Stonewall riots, I was a reporter for the Village Voice, locked inside with the police, covering it for my column. It really did appear that crowd, because we could look through little peepholes in the plywood windows. We could look out, and we could see that the crowd, well, my guess was within 5-10 minutes, it was probably several thousand people. And 2,000, easy. And they were yelling, kill the cops, police brutality, let's get them, we're not going to take this anymore, let's get them.
We noticed a group of persons attempting to uproot one of the parking meters, in which they did succeed. And they then used that parking meter to as a battering ram to break down the door. And they did, in fact, open the door. They crashed it in. And at that point was when they began throwing Molotov cocktails into the place. It was a situation that we didn't know how we were going to be able to control.
I remember someone throwing a Molotov cocktail. I don't know who the person was, but I mean, I saw that, and I just said to myself in Spanish, I said, oh my God, the revolution is finally here. And I just like started screaming, freedom. We're free at last, you know, and it felt really good.
There were a couple of cops stationed on either side of the door with their pistols, like in a combat stance, aimed in the door area. A couple others were stationed in other places, behind like a pole, another one behind the bar, all of them with their guns ready. I don't think up to that point I had ever seen cops that scared.
Remember, these were pros, but everybody was frightened. There's no question about that. I know I was frightened, and I've been in combat situations, and there was never any time that I felt more scared than I felt that night. And I mean, there was just, you know, there was no place to run.
When the Morrill Squad officers barricaded themselves inside the Stonewall, Deputy Inspector Pine put in a 1041 call, an emergency help request which can only be placed by a high-ranking officer. That call was mysteriously canceled, and the telephone inside the Stonewall went dead. It took nearly 45 minutes for the riot police to get to the Stonewall and rescue the Morrill Squad from the smoldering bar.
Once the tactical police force showed up, I think that really incited us a little bit more.
My name is Martin Boyce, and in 1969, I was a drag queen known as Miss Martin. I remember on that night, when we saw the riot police, all of us drag queens, we linked arms like the Rockettes and sang the song we used to sing. We are the village girls. We wear our hair in curls. We wear our dungarees above our Nelly knees. And the police went crazy hearing that, and they just immediately rushed us. We gave one kick and fled.
My name is Rudy, and the night of the Stonewall, I was 18. And to tell you the truth, that night I was doing more running than fighting. I remember looking back from 10th Street. And there on Waverly Street, there was a police, I believe, on his cop, and is on his stomach in his tactical uniform and his helmet and everything else, with a drag queen straddling him. She was beating the hell out of him with her shoe. Whether it was a high heel or not, I don't know. But she was beating the hell out of him. It was hysterical.
My name is Mama Jean. I'm a lesbian, and I guess you would label me as a butch. I remember on that night, I was in a gay bar, a women's bar, called Cookies. We were coming out of the gay bar, going toward 8th Street. And that's when we saw everything happen, blasting away, people getting beat up, police coming from every direction, hitting women as well as men with their nightsticks, gay men running down the street with blood all over their face. We decided right then and there whether we were scared or not. We didn't think about it. We just jumped in.
But here, this queen is going completely bananas, you know, jumping and hitting the windshield. And next thing you know, the taxi cab was being turned over. Other cars were being turned over. Things, windows were shattering all over the place. Fires were burning around the place. It was beautiful. It really was.
I remember one cop coming at me, hitting me with the nightstick in the back of my legs. I broke loose, and I went after him. I grabbed his nightstick. My girlfriend went behind him. She was a strong 7-gun. I wanted him to feel the same pain I felt. And I kept on saying to him, "How do you like the pain? Do you like it? Do you like it?" And I kept on hitting him and hitting him. I was angry. I wanted to kill him. At that particular minute, I wanted to
do every destructive thing that I could think of at that time to hurt anyone that had hurt us through the years.
It's like just when you see a man protecting his own life. They weren't the queens that people call them. They were men fighting for their lives. And I'd fight alongside them any day, no matter how old I was.
A lot of heads were bashed. A lot of people were hurt. But it didn't hurt their true feelings. They all came back for more. Nothing. That's when you could tell that nothing could stop us at that time, but any time in the future.
The media covered the riot extensively. The Daily News featured it on its front page. There were reports on all the local television and radio stations. By the next day, graffiti calling for gay power had appeared on buildings and sidewalks all over the West Village. Hastily worked up flyers, distributed on street corners, touted the night as the hairpin drop heard round the world. And the next night, thousands of men and women converged on the West Village. They came here, back to the Stonewall, to see what would happen next. While trash cans were set on fire, stones were thrown, and sporadic fighting broke out between police and gays, the more than 400 riot police milling around the village ensured that the previous night's violence would not be repeated. But on this night, for the first time, gay couples could be seen walking hand in hand or kissing in the streets. Just by being there, surrounded by reporters and photographers and onlookers, thousands of men and women were proclaiming to themselves and the rest of the world that they were gay. And the crowds grew and came back the next night, and for one more night the following week. What happened here on those nights helped to usher in a new era, both personally and politically, for gay men and lesbians.
When Stonewall happened, Bruce and I were still in the closet, where we had been for nearly 40 years. But we realized that this was a tremendous thing that had happened at Stonewall, and it gave us a feeling that we were not going to be remaining closeted for very much longer. And soon thereafter, we did come out of the closet.
My name is Ginny Apuzzo. In 1969, I was in the convent. I was in the Sisters of Charity. And when Stonewall hit the press, it hit me with a bolt of lightning. It was as if I had an incredible release of my own outrage at having to sequester so much of my life. I made my way down. I seem to recall in subsequent nights being down on the, you know, kind of just in the periphery looking, observer, clearly an observer, clearly longing to have that courage to come out. And it was only a matter of weeks before I left the convent and started a new life.
I'm Henry Baird. In 1969, I was in the U.S. Army, a Specialist 3 stationed at Long Binh Post near Saigon in Vietnam. I remember I was having lunch in the Army mess, reading the Armed Forces news summary of the day. And there was a short paragraph describing a riot led by homosexuals in Greenwich Village against the police. And my heart was filled with joy. I thought about what I had read frequently, but I had no one to discuss it with. And secretly within myself, I decided that when I came back stateside, if I should survive to come back stateside, I would come out as a gay person. And I did.
For those of us in public morals, after the Stonewall incident, things were completely changed from what they had previously been. They suddenly were not submissive anymore. They now suddenly had gained a new type of courage. And it seemed as if they didn't care anymore about whether they were whether their identities were made known. We were now dealing with human beings.
My name is Jim Forat, and I'm in the mid-60s, along with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. I was one of the founders of the Yippie movement. I remember on the third night of the riots, there was this meeting called by Mattachine Society at St. John's Church on Waverly Place. We went, and Randy Wicker was running the meeting.
For 10 years, I've been going on television as Randy Wicker, the respectable homosexual dressed in dark suit and tie, explaining to people that most homosexuals look like everybody else and behave like everybody else. And when Stonewall began happening, you had chorus lines of queens kicking their heels up at the police, and bonfires burning in the corner trash baskets and throwing bricks and stones at the police. I was horrified because this violated everything that we thought of as responsible behavior, that this was not the way respectable citizens behaved.
Evelyn Hooker was a sociologist, I believe. Randy had introduced her, and she got up and she suggested that we should have a candlelight march, that we should turn the other cheek because gay people were really different, we were really nice, and we had to show how nice we were and stop all this rioting because people were going to get hurt. I remember I stood up, and I said, no, we are not going back. And people felt the same thing I felt. And we marched out of that room, and that was the night that the Gay Liberation Front was born.
Today, I live in a senior citizen apartment building. What's different now is that I can be free. I have a daughter who's a senior citizen, and my son is 58. They know about my homosexuality. My three grandchildren in their 30s know about their grandmother. I have a great-granddaughter who, at the age of 10, learned that Grandma Jerry was a lesbian, and she thought that was most interesting. And yet I still don't have the personal courage to not care if these yentas in the building know that Jerry's a lesbian.
Well, I retired from the police department in 1976. 20 years have passed. I'm going to be 70 in a few months. I still don't know the answer. I would still like to know the answer. I would like to know whether I was wrong or whether I was right in ever thinking that there was a difference, and ever thinking that maybe you shouldn't trust a homosexual because something is missing in his personality.
The archives of lesbian culture, which surrounds us now and was created 4 years after Stonewall, owes, at least for my part, its creation to that night and the courage that found its voice in the streets. That night, in some very deep way, we finally found our place in history. Not as a dirty joke, not as a doctor's case study, not as a freak, but as a people.
You have been listening to Remembering Stonewall, the documentary on the Stonewall Rebellion. We are featuring it here on KPFT tonight as part of a celebration of historic recordings from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Please give us a call, 713-526-5738, to make a pledge of support. Again, that's 713-526-KPFT. I'm Ernesto Aguilar, KPFT's program director. I've got Matt out at Pledge Central.
Howdy-ho.
And we are waiting for a couple of calls this evening, 713-526-5738. Please make that pledge of support, 713-526-KPFT. Matt, we had a good time last Monday. Very, very good evening. But right now, we need to get a couple more calls.
Yes, we do.
713-526-5738. You can pick up this Remembering Stonewall documentary. We'll try to get to the conclusion of it in just a few minutes and feature a little bit more from the Pacifica Radio Archives this hour, but we want to hear from you. Please go to your phone, dial 713-526-KPFT. We return to Remembering Stonewall. Please make that pledge of support. It is available for your contribution. Call us at Pledge Central. We'll get you taken care of. 713-526-5738.
The disorders began with a routine police raid on a homosexual bar, the Stonewall, on Christopher Street, in the heart of the West Village.
Reporter Brett Artery's documentary about the June 1969 Stonewall Rebellion.
By the end of the week, scores of police and rioters had been injured. Many were arrested, and one man, a cab driver, was dead. Almost every homosexual who was in New York at the time of the Stonewall Rebellion has his own private memory of what took place. One of the longtime leaders of the gay rights movement, Craig Rodwell, remembers it this way.
As I was there every night, the first night was Friday. I was on the way home from a friend's house. The raid was just starting at that time, and we noticed the crowd, so we went over there. And a crowd was gathering out in front, and there was a paddy wagon pulled up, and a few people being taken out. The crowd was very quiet at the time. I wasn't. I started yelling gay power and get the mafia out of the bars, and my lover nudged me and told me to shut up. But within about 15 minutes, the crowds really started doing it, going really far, much further beyond what I would have done or did. It started with a few coins and pebbles being thrown at the police, and then the police retreated into the Stonewall, and parking meters were brought out, and chants of gay power and get the mafia out of the bars. And then after the police barricaded themselves inside, it was like half an hour later, the riot police started moving up Christopher, breaking up the crowd, which had really become a very angry crowd with hundreds of bottles and rocks. There wasn't one window left in the whole place after about 10 minutes. And they broke the crowd up into small groups, and this went on for like 2 or 3 hours, back and forth in the whole area. I think they thought the people would just go home or run, especially since they were gay people. They're not used to gay people standing up at all, especially in front of police. But the people would, they would chase the people away and they would go around the block and come in another way. And this sort of tug of war went on all evening. And then on Saturday night, it was much the same thing. Starting about 9, crowds started to gather in the area, sort of small groups on the sidewalk. And then around 11 or 12, they started taking over the street, stopping cars from coming through, unless there were gay people in them. A few fires were set. But generally, it was an angry mood, a lot of chanting, a lot of hand-holding, a lot of assertion of being gay. And that, it was a way of saying we're tired of hiding, tired of leading two lives, tired of denying our basic identity, denying ourselves. A general assertion of gay people, the newfound pride, really, a collective pride in their identity.
The Stonewall Rebellion served notice on the heterosexual majority that a growing number of gays were not afraid anymore and were not content to continue living out their lives in fear and oppression.
They say I'm crazy, got no sense, but I don't care. They may or may not mean offense, but I don't care. You see, I'm sort of independent. I am my own superintendent, and my star is on the ascendant. That's why I don't care. I don't care. I don't care what they may think of me. I'm happy-go-lucky. They say that I'm plucky, contented, and carefree. I don't care. I don't care if I do get a mean and stony stare. If I'm not successful, it won't be distressful, 'cause I don't care.
The Stonewall Rebellion will be remembered as one of the major turning points in the homosexual struggle for equality. Dr. Franklin Kameny, president of the Washington, D.C. Mattachine Society, explains why.
Whatever one may think of the merits of that particular form of expression of protest or dissent, and whatever you may think of the merits of that particular demonstration, those are not that relevant. That what's important is the message which is being conveyed. And that should be made absolutely clear. And that is that we've been shoved around for 3,000 years, and we're tired of it, and we're starting to shove back. And if we don't get what's coming to us and get it promptly, there's going to be a lot more shoving back.
Craig Rodwell says
it still is a relatively small minority of gay people who do reflect this new spirit, whatever you want to call it. But the fact that there is a minority or a group of gay people or a large group reflecting it is very important. And I think it's going to infect the masses of gay people in the coming years.
Another important outgrowth of the riots was the formation of numerous action-oriented homosexual groups in New York and around the country. Of course, Mattachine societies and similar groups had been around for years, but these new organizations were different. They're composed for the most part of younger and more militant homosexuals. Some of these groups formed before the rebellion, but after the Stonewall, they grew rapidly in strength and in numbers. One of the largest of the new organizations in New York is the Gay Liberation Front. Bob Kohler tells when it was founded.
June 28th, 69, the day after the riots.
Was it forming, or was there a lot of movement toward an organization like this before the Stonewall incident?
No, almost none. Mattachine had come out on the streets with an action committee during the riots, but it wasn't answering the needs of the people. And a group of people from that action committee formed GLF.
Another young group in New York is the Gay Activists Alliance. We asked one of its leaders, Marty Robinson, what the purpose of the organization is.
GA is utilizing nonviolent militancy to secure what it wants, somewhat by hitting the system below the belt rather than just trying to cut the rug out from under the system entirely.
A third example of the new breed of gay activist groups is Homosexuals in Transigent of New York. HI's president, Joshua Harris, tells of their program.
Right now,
we're changing our complete structure. Our structure was a very small, tight group of men, basically. But now we're trying to open our arms and embrace our sisters, as well as our other brothers, our older brothers, as well as the younger people in the city that have a lot to offer. And we're going to try to incorporate this in such a way so, like, our programs, especially our new programs, we're starting new programs such as HELPS, which is housing, education, law study, psychology, and basic services for the gay people, which will open up new doors to other people in this city. And will also make people that are in this city, heterosexuals, aware of our problems, aware of our needs, so they don't frown on us, so they don't have this backward look to us. This is what we're trying to do. This is what HI is about.
Most of the people in these new groups are of college age or just beyond. And many gay high school students are also beginning to become active in the fight for their rights. Of course, New York City is not unique. New and more militant groups have sprung up all over the country. In Boston, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Detroit, and in many smaller cities. Another outgrowth of all this new activism has been the rise in the gay press. Several papers now exist in major cities across the country. One of the most successful in New York is simply called Gay. And its executive editor, Jack Nichols, describes the paper's aim.
What we intend to do with Gay, actually, is to make it, if we can, the very most informative and literate and entertaining publication that we possibly can. We want to reflect the best thinking by the best gay writers in the United States on all different kinds of topics from different points of view. And we'd like to see the words homosexual and heterosexual both fade away. Because we feel that people should relate to each other as people rather than as homosexuals and heterosexuals.
One of the oldest newspapers is the Los Angeles Advocate, which has a national circulation. It probably carries more news than any other gay paper and has what might be described as a moderate editorial policy. Some radical gays in the movement have criticized it as being old time. The editor-in-chief, Dick Michaels, described the paper's editorial position this way.
The Advocate itself is opposed to violence. We are not opposed to militancy. I want to make that clear. But we are very much opposed to violence that puts us in the same category as the people who are trying to oppress us.
Politicians have generally tried to deal with the problems of all their constituents. In the past, homosexuals were the exception. Well, this situation is beginning to change with the advent of the new gay activist groups. In Los Angeles, the Advocate has been involved in politics for quite some time. Editor Dick Michaels describes the outcome of one particularly important contest.
A year ago, we were useful in a city council election. A city councilman from Hollywood, Paul Lamport, was up for re-election, and he was very bad on gays. So in the primary, we backed an openly gay candidate who did not have much of a chance of getting the nomination. But we wanted to see how many votes he would get. So he wound up getting over 3,000 votes, I believe. Then in the actual election, Lamport ran against a man named Stevenson, and we came out openly against Lamport. And backed Stevenson, even though we didn't know a heck of a lot about him, but we knew Lamport was bad. Well, Lamport lost by roughly 3,000 votes.
In San Francisco for the past few years, every candidate for mayor and some of the state legislative candidates have seen fit to address the gay community specifically and ask for its support. In New York, the Gay Activists Alliance has begun to confront politicians openly on the streets. They attempted to ask questions of Arthur Goldberg, the Democratic candidate for governor, during a campaign stop at 86th Street and Broadway in Manhattan. When Goldberg refused to respond to the gay people's questions, they proceeded to shout him down and drive him away. The demonstrators surrounded his car and protested his silence. After the incident was over, Jim Owls, president of the Gay Activist Alliance, was asked what he felt the confrontation had accomplished.
Well, I think we showed Arthur Goldberg that whenever he makes an appearance in the city, he has to be willing to speak to his homosexual constituents. He said that he didn't think it was an important enough issue, but obviously if he went into a black neighborhood, he would speak to the black problems, or he would have gotten the same reaction. So we're just going to let him know that wherever he appears, he's going to expect the same type of thing.
A few days later, at a candidates' night sponsored by the Greenwich Village Association, gay people were vocal in demanding that all candidates come out with a strong and positive statement supporting their rights. And most of them did. GAA leader Marty Robinson attacked incumbent Congressman Leonard Farbstein for not representing the gay community in his own district.
I spoke to Congressman Farbstein at a private fundraising gathering with three other members of Gay Activists Alliance. First, he gave us his liberal credentials. He sent $10 to a needy black in Arkansas who needed shoes. Is really to lift the problems of the nation. And then I asked him about homosexuals being fired in Wall Street because they cannot get bonds because bonding companies in the state of New York will not give a bond to a known homosexual. And Congressman Farbstein has done nothing, spoken out not at all of the subject, and at this moment, hundreds of gays have lost their jobs. I accuse the congressman of negligence of office, and I think any homosexual who votes for the congressman is out of his head. Right on!
You are listening to a segment of Remembering Stonewall, the Pacifica Radio Archives From the Vault special documentary on the Stonewall Rebellion. We are asking for your contribution this evening. I'm Ernesto Aguilar, KPFT's program director. Matt is out at Pledge Central.
Howdy, howdy.
713-526-5738 is the number to call. 713-526-KPFT to make your pledge of support. 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT. Looks like we've got one call on the line. We need to get a couple more calls going right now. You can pick up that Remembering Stonewall documentary hour that you've heard this hour for your pledge of support. That $200 pledge will get you 100 hours of programming. Remembering Stonewall plus 99 more hours. Some great stuff that you can get for your pledge of support. So please give us a call. We're going to change gears the rest of the hour and bring you something else from that Pacifica Radio Archives From the Vault set. That 100 hours of programming again available for your pledge. And we'll be bringing you The Feminist Journey featuring Gloria Steinem, Germaine Greer, Bella Abzug, and many other important voices of the feminist movement, featured as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives From the Vault set. Your pledge of support will get you this hour, the segment you just heard, and much more. The 1979 March on Washington, which you heard in the previous hour. Right now, we need to ask for your pledge of support. 713-526-5738.
Hi, I'm Halnani Singer. And this is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archive series that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. Today, we'll hear excerpts from Pacifica Radio Archive's Sounds That Changed the World National Marathon, broadcast on November 27, 2007. This particular hour, hosted by KPFK's free speech news journalist Auda Bogado, focuses on the feminist movement. In this hour, Pacifica Radio Archives From the Vault brings you the voices of everyday women, the driving force behind this movement. The voices of Betty Friedan, Germaine Greer, Gloria Steinem, and Bell Hooks, women who inspire the feminist movement. And as well, the notable voices of Representative Bella Abzug and Senator Barbara Boxer. Brought to you from the Pacifica Radio Archives Historic Collection, ladies and gentlemen, From the Vault presents Feminist Journey.
Good evening, and thanks for tuning in to Sounds That Changed the World. I'm Aura Bogado, host of Free Speech Radio News, coming to you live from Pacifica Station KPFK in L.A. This hour, we bring you feminist journeys. It's not just girl talk. In this hour, we'll be bringing you some very rare recordings from the early days of the women's programming here at Pacifica. And among my guests today are women who helped pioneer that phenomenon. Addie Givens, would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, yeah, I'm Addie Givens, and I was a longtime volunteer and programmer at KPFA in Berkeley, and I am now the project coordinator of the Preservation Access Project at the Archives.
Lucia, let's move on to you.
I'm Lucia Chappelle, and I was one of the first women in the Women's Coalition here at KPFK back in the mid-70s, I guess probably 75. And I was also on staff here as traffic and later became program director of KPFK for about 7 years.
Wow. And Nani, let's move on to you.
Hi, I'm Haunani Singer, and I'm so glad to be with these wonderful women. I produced Studs Terkel, The Spoken Century in last year's fund drive, and I'm presently producing the Pacifica Radio Archive series From the Vault.
And finally, Susan.
Hi, my name is Susan Rubin. I'm here tonight representing the Feminist Majority Foundation and Ms. Magazine. I'm a feminist playwright and documentarian.
And Susan, we'll definitely be talking with you. You're with us today to talk about this important new relationship that's forming between the Feminist Majority and Pacifica Radio Archives.
Right.
But for our listeners, I want to let you know that we have a jam-packed hour of programming to bring you. Addie, why don't you start us off?
Okay, well, there's a lot of really seminal feminist history in the Pacifica Radio Archives. Stuff that, you know, either you never heard, you didn't know existed, or isn't what you thought it was. It's extremely powerful stuff. And Lucia and I are both familiar with a lot of the material because we put a lot of it in there and we've worked with a lot of it before. And then it's really exciting to have Nani here because she's just started working with this material. She produced, we're going to play this little montage. We started this out with the song Bread and Roses, which was a song that was written off of the placards that these women textile workers were carrying this huge strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1912. And that really became sort of like a signature of the women's movement, of the feminist movement in several waves.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, that a sudden sun discloses for the people hear us singing bread and roses, bread and roses.
In the old days, in the early part of this second wave of feminism, there was consciousness raising.
There was consciousness raising, and it turned out that just about every station had a program that was called something like Women Hold Up Half the Sky. All those programs began with Bread and Roses. So that was one of the things that really cracked us up. But another thing, when we were looking to see what kind of women's programming was preserved in the archives, we found this tape of actually a whole series of consciousness-raising sessions from the early 70s that were actually conducted live on WBAI. I mean, this is incredible.
If I had known earlier in my life about Mother Jones or some of the strong women that had come before me, if I'd had some of those role models, I might have acknowledged my own capabilities much earlier in life. It took me till I was maybe 22 to go, ah.
I'm Laura, and I'm gay. I'm 21 years old, and I feel that my life is, I feel much better about my life because of the consciousness I've gained through the women's movement, and my gay lifestyle has made me feel really good about my life, too.
My name is Lee, and I'm 23, and I live with my husband and my son. Presently, my husband and I have an arrangement where I work full-time to support the three of us, and my husband stays home and does childcare and the housework.
I abominate feminism and this dividing business, but I think there is a difference in what women might contribute.
As recently as 1970, you could find Dr. Edgar Berman, who was Hubert Humphrey's personal physician and got the limelight that way, declaring that women were unfit for leadership because of our, quote, raging hormonal imbalances, close quote. So how could, you know, the idea was, how could a woman conduct business if she were having a period? Impossible.
I had fully intended to hold my tongue after the female unit. I fully meant not to try to raise consciousness again, not to write another primer for consciousness raising. I always expected someone else to arise.
The question of feminism, and feminism to me is about sexism, ending sexism and sexist oppression. It's about a political movement. That is about us as black women. But it's not the same kind of feminism that started out as a kind of equal rights with white men's movement.
Let's not ask of ourselves that we be miraculously better than any, you know, than men in politics. Don't you know that there's never been a movement like this, as large as this? I mean, as potentially as large in your country, as really large in my country, there would be no way to get that movement all in one organization. Furthermore, in the ways of an advanced technological society, it is too easy to co-opt. It is too easy to co-opt one organization. I prefer guerrilla warfare. I prefer, you know, ad hoc, relatively autonomous groups. Even my organization now, which I helped build, I created quite consciously, or helped to create, a structure with a maximum of local autonomy. A maximum of... so to create local decision-making leadership. Now, that there should be differences, yes, there are differences. There's... when you cross such a gamut of generation gap, of race, of economic, of style, of lifestyle, of race, of everything that you do in the women's movement, to say nothing of the geography of a huge country like the U.S., much less the world, the amazing thing is the amount of unity. But I also believe that enemies of the women's movement, including some of those agents that may have been infiltrating it, have been trying to turn us against each other and divide us against each other and have been creating such splits. They destroyed the student movement virtually. They did a lot to emasculate the black movement, or whatever you want to call it. And we had some narrow escapes in the women's movement.
They're gonna be mad. They're gonna be mad at me and you. They're gonna be mad at us and all the things we wanna do. They're gonna be mad at us. They're gonna be mad at me and you.
To sit in this room, this multi-ethnic room with feminists, and, you know, from the U.S. that represents so many different struggles, decades of struggle, is, first of all, for me, it's such an honor. And for the people that are out there listening, if you appreciate this, I mean, you're not going to get this on any other media entity. You're not going to be able to turn on any radio station, much less a TV station, and hear all these perspectives and hear not only the voices of people that made history and continue to make history, but those people that also cared enough, those women that cared enough to archive it and to preserve it.
You know, it's really, really wonderful. I just discovered so much when I started to do this project. Hearing all these voices like Elsa Knight Thompson, who you heard in the montage, who was here at Pacifica and who was so instrumental in opening things up for women, being a wonderful journalist as she was. Another thing that I discovered was a recording of Germaine Greer, and it's notable because she was a feminist, author of The Female Eunuch, and the first woman invited to speak at the National Press Club. This is May, 1971.
If you could choose your sex, would you prefer to be a man? I don't really write these questions.
That's all right. Can I have a cigarette? That's a strange sort of question. Because the thing is, you know, when people ask you questions like that, they're false questions because they're based on a false premise. You're under no obligation to answer them. But I suppose I'll answer it just the same. I have never regretted being a woman because it's pointless. It's like suicide. It's the ultimate pointless activity. I am a woman. I may regret what women are in this society. I may regret the way in which I was hung about with prohibitions that meant that so much of my early life was spent in struggling to break free just so that I could do something. I still don't know how much I actually suffered. There's a tremendous arrogance in the male attitude that says to me, well, you've got a PhD and you've written a book, obviously nothing's hampered you. And I always think, how the hell do you know I'm not Einstein? Instead of a... I think I could say this, though. That of all the times to be a woman, this is possibly the most exciting time there has ever been.
And the joy of being able to actually do something, of actually having this power to move and not being chained to birth, miscarriage, and death. The joy of actually being able to discover my sisters and to find how amazing it is to be able to be with women, talking about our own affairs, to feel the energy release that there is astonishing. It's something I was never prepared for. It may be something that men have always known because of the way they have interacted with each other to rule the world and because of the things that they have achieved this way. But for women, I'm sure it's a new feeling. And the excitement is so extraordinary that I cannot even think of ways to tell you about it, except that whenever you're with a group of women who are getting their thing together, the atmosphere is so effervescent, so extraordinary, and the faces are so amazing of these girls, suddenly so open and so unafraid, that I'm really very glad to be a woman, and I'm pretty glad not to be a man right now.
If you're listening from New York, this next clip that we have coming up, we're going to be listening to Bella Abzug,
mm-hmm.
who I grew up with back on the East Coast. And it's shocking to me now how many people say, who? Who is that?
And you know what? I was one of those people a few years ago until I heard about her in the Pacifica Radio Archives. This is Bella Abzug. She is this amazing woman in history. She was a lawyer. She was a... You know, she said a woman's place is in the House of Representatives. She flipped the way that people perceived women and women's power at a time when a lot of people were scared to do it, frankly.
Mrs. Abzug, you came to Congress with an idealistic outlook. Can you relate the difficulties you're running into in trying to better the world? Have you modified your goals as a result? And what do you consider your greatest contributions in Congress so far?
Well, I still have my same outlook. I think it may be apparent. I came to Washington not having too many illusions. You've got to understand that, whoever asked this question. But I am a little shocked about the rigidity of the power structure that is in Congress. And the reason I'm shocked by it is not that I didn't expect it to be tough and committee run and hard to break through in many ways, but because, in fact, it's not a very representative body. The fact is there are very few young people in Congress. There are not only not enough women in Congress, there are very few really minorities represented when you consider the plethora and the kind of minorities in this country. There are very few people who are not lawyers or businessmen. There are very few artists and very few scientists and very few educators. There are very few real representatives of the total diversity that America is and which makes America so wonderful. And the thing that has really upset me about Congress is we got to make it that kind of Congress. Otherwise, it will never become responsive to human needs. And its rigidity doesn't lie only in the fact that it has a seniority system, which returns men to Congress for 82 years. My mother's 82 years. I love her, but I wouldn't elect her to Congress. And so what has upset me is, in fact, when I then come back and I look at some of these congressmen and I say to myself, you're not even representing your people. Until now, I thought you couldn't help it because that's what your people were like. But your people are not like that. It's you who is that way, all by yourself. This is a tough audience. It took me 1 hour and 10 minutes to get anything out of it. And that's why I feel so gratified and so encouraged at the formation of this National Women's Political Caucus. I think my greatest contribution is that I speak up all the time, inside Congress and outside of Congress. And I try to explain where the people are. And I try to explain that somebody like me, who is essentially an activist, that doesn't come out of the club structure per se, but comes out of the movements of social change, is a great, warm human being. And that there isn't anything wrong with the things that I stand for, and that I'm a very nice person, and we can all figure out a ways to work together if we become human. What I'm trying to get a lot of these people to do is be human. If we begin to be human, we can represent human beings. If we're not human, just politicians, we will never represent human beings and the human needs in this country.
Bella Abzug. She was a representative in the U.S. Congress from New York City, and she was incredible. She was speaking at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the National Press Boys Club, we might say, in Washington, D.C. in 1971.
I just wanted to say that if anyone thought that the women's movement had no sense of humor, I hope you just heard Bella Abzug. I think that pretty much puts the end to that part of the conversation for good. And I would challenge anyone to be as funny, as smart as she was in those hats she wore, and to still be taken seriously many, many years after she's not here to speak for herself.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio. This is KPFT Houston. You are listening to The Feminist Journey, brought to you from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Your number to call right now, please go to your phone. Fabulous stuff that we're hearing on this program, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. The Feminist Journey is included in the From the Vault 100 set. That 100 hours of programming is available for your $200 pledge. Please go to your phone right now and dial 713-526-KPFT. I've got Robert out at Pledge Central ready to take your call. He's been sitting tough with us, hanging tough is probably a better way to put that, all evening long. Thanks to you so much, Robert, for sticking it out. And thank you to you who are headed to the phones. We don't have any calls right now. We'd love to thank you. So have mercy on us, please, and pledge right now. 713-526-5738. That's the number to call right now. We head back to The Feminist Journey, the Pacifica Radio Archive special we're bringing you this evening. 713-526-KPFT is the number. 713-526-KPFT. Stay tuned.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.